It's time to say goodnight to inefficient night storage heaters. Bulky, unattractive, with no precise control, leaving you boiling in the morning and rather chilly at night. So tune in to Fisher Future Heat, home heating systems that give you a steady, controllable supply of heat 24 hours a day. Search Fisher Future Heat today. Fisher Future Heat. The future is electric.
Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello, I'm Matt Hansen.
And I'm Tristan Riddell.
And you're listening to the Nerd Party.
Talk nerdy to me.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome. This is episode 4 of the Nerd Party, and we have quite a show for you today. We have been doing lots and lots, copious, if you will, amounts of research on this topic, and it's one of our favorite topics. And what is that, Matt?
Yes, we're going to do our big tribute to Robin Williams, the late, great Robin Williams, this week. Tristan and I have been sitting through a lot of Robin Williams films, just kind of reminiscing and going over childhood memories, or at least I have, and we're going to be sharing those with you tonight.
And before we get into that, we're going to talk about something that's a little bit in the news, and that's one thing that both Matt and I are very excited about, and that is the video game coming out in October, and that is Aliens Isolation.
Alien Isolation.
Excuse me. That's a very important distinction.
It is, because unlike so many other Alien games before this, this is not based off the James Cameron sequel. Rather, it is going to be a game very much in the spirit of the Ridley Scott 1979 original Alien.
And that is definitely my favorite of the four Alien movies, is the Ridley Scott original. I'm not just saying that because I'm a big Ridley Scott fan or because it's an original and because it's hip to say, oh, you know, the original is so much better. No, it was just so creepy and eerie and just so slimy. It's just so great, and I'm just so happy that this video game is going to be based off of that, and you have no guns in the game. Like, you have makeshift weapons that you have to collect parts of all over the level, and you have to evade the alien, and like, they have music that goes along with what's happening in the story. I mean, it'll go up and down depending on the situation and how you react to certain situations. I mean, we have a limited version of that recently, but this is going to be like nothing we've seen before when it comes to music integration.
And I don't know if you've seen the gameplay videos that have come out of like E3, Tristan, but it is super, super scary. And I'm not a gamer by any sense of the imagination. The last game system that I could play really well was the N64. So that's how out of touch I am as far as gaming is concerned. This makes me want to catch up, though, because I saw that footage, and not only is it the music atmospheric, it's very creepy. When the alien does come looking for you, I mean, there are times where, like, you can go into a closet, and then literally it'll be face-to-face with you outside the closet door, and then you have to push a button to stop your character from breathing so it can't hear you. I mean, it's really visceral.
I didn't know that. I didn't know there was a button to hold your breath.
Yes, there's a button. Like, if the alien hears you breathing really hard, it'll find you. So there's a button to make the character hold their breath.
That is so freaking cool. I am so excited for this game. It comes out in October, and I've already pre-ordered it. And I'll tell you the main reason why I pre-ordered it, because I very rarely do that with games. I'm not a big gamer, but I'm more of a gamer than you. But not by much. I mean, I don't spend that much money on games whatsoever, and I'm not going to get an Xbox One because the only reason why I'd get an Xbox One is for the new Batman game, and that's just not enough to drop $500 to $600. But
you had an amazing reason for pre-ordering this game, and this is really special, you guys.
And yes, the reason why I pre-ordered this game is because if you pre-order it, you can play the Nostromo levels with the entire original cast voiceover actors.
That's right. They got the entire 1979 cast, who are fortunately all still with us, and they recorded each their original characters. I mean, we've got Sigourney Weaver doing Ripley's voice for the first time, I believe, in an Alien game. We've got all of them. Tom Skerritt, Ian Holm, John Hurt, Veronica Cartwright, Harry Dean Stanton, and Yaphet Kotto. They all came back for this game.
They all came back, and the first thing that I thought about was, oh, this is amazing, bam, instant buy. And then the second thing was, it's been a long time. These people are going to sound different.
At this point, Tristan, though, who cares? It's an alien reunion.
Exactly. You're right. You're right. Exactly. Who, they may sound different. They may sound older, but who cares?
And honestly, too, I mean, I do agree with you, but Sigourney Weaver pretty much sounds the same as she did. Maybe a little bit older, but she pretty much has the same voice.
Because she is timeless. That is why. We forgot to mention that the story takes place between Alien and Aliens, and the protagonist is Ripley's daughter. And it follows, as we said, the same kind of feel as the first one. And I'm glad that we get to see another Ripley, and we get to see the exploits of her daughter, and that on bonus levels, we get the entire cast. I mean, from any Alien fan, how could you not buy this?
And it's perfect timing, too, because 2014 just happens to be, I believe it's the 35th anniversary of the original film.
I didn't know that, man. You're giving me all sorts of Alien facts tonight.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of this franchise, you guys. And Tristan, I think we're going to have to do an Alien retrospective at some point.
When we were in the planning stages for this podcast, that was one of the first things that we thought about doing was an Alien retrospective, just because we're such intense fans. All right, well, we don't want to spend too much time on it because we do have a lot to cover when it comes to Robin Williams. And first, what we're going to do is we're going to break it up into two sections, and that is genre films and non-genre films. And now when we say genre films, we mean fantasy projects, science fiction, and things that kind of stretch the imagination. And Robin Williams has made a lot of really cool genre films. And we're just going to go in temporal order for the genre films, and we're going to bounce around for the non-genre films. But right off the bat, one of his first movies, Popeye.
Yes, Robert Altman, director of such classics as Nashville and the movie version of MASH, directs what is considered a kid's property, and yet it's a film that I feel is not very well regarded in moviegoers' opinion.
No, I'd have to agree with you on that one. It came out in 1980, the tail end of 1980, and it's very tongue in cheek, it's very over the top, and I don't think a lot of people got it. And to be honest with you, I mean, as a fan of Altman's work as I am, I don't know. I feel like Altman kind of missed the mark on this one. I mean, but the thing is, though, that source material, I mean, how do you portray that source material in a proper cinematic form? It's just too hard.
And I think you'll agree with me. I have some nostalgic picks as far as this genre is concerned, but cartoon to movie transitions haven't always worked that well.
Yeah, and this is like, you know, comic strip to cartoon to movie transition, and it's hard. I mean, now granted, it's kind of like when The Phantom came out. This, man, I feel like The Phantom might have even been a little bit more successful, at least monetarily. You know, that was based off of a comic strip, and that failed miserably, but I enjoyed it. And there's a nostalgic side of me that enjoys Popeye, and it's very Robin Williams, because he's muttering to himself, and he's, you know, he's cracking jokes, even though you can barely hear him. And it's Robin Williams doing a funky voice in weird makeup. And so, you know, it's basically calling to his key demographic at that time.
You know what? I will give credit to Popeye, and not just Popeye, but all of Robin Williams' performance, is he's one actor who I feel that even if he was in a terrible film, he never, ever phoned it in. He always committed. And I think that's very rare among Hollywood actors these days, when you see people just taking work for the paycheck. I don't believe he ever did that, or at least it never came across that way in any of his films to me.
I absolutely have to agree. I mean, we're, as we said before, we're big fans, and we're not the only ones. He was beloved all over for not just his comedy, not just his dramatic roles, but for his weird films like this. And moving on, his next genre film didn't come around until 1991 with Hook. And all of us know Hook. All of us know the story. It takes place after what we know from Peter Pan and Neverland and everything like that, about how Peter Pan's all grown up. What would the world be like? And Hook comes in to the real world to steal his children. And Robert Williams, going by Peter Banning, has to go back to Neverland and rescue his kids. And for those of you who haven't seen this film, go watch it. It's so much fun. There's so many key one-liners in there. Man, just there's so many key one-liners and so many key images, like going from Bangarang to Julia Roberts as Tinkerbell.
Yeah, it's just right.
There's so many great things about this movie, but I have to admit that it's probably easier for you to love it if you loved it as a child.
That's what I was going to say. I believe it's another one at the time where it was sort of divisive among audiences. But the ones that I do find really like it are the ones that were children or saw the movie as a child when it was released or around the time it was released. So it seems to have a nice sense of nostalgia about it. And really, I mean, we're going to see this with another movie on this list here. But who better than Robin Williams to play someone who doesn't want to grow up? You know, he just had like a childlike quality about him all the time.
Yeah, it's like the healthy version of Michael Jackson, where he just doesn't want to grow up and have fun and go on roller coasters and make funny voices all the time. Well, since we have so much on our list, we'll move forward and let's move into his voice work. And this one came out in the next year in 1992. And no, it's not the one that you're thinking of. This one actually came before that, and that's Ferngully, The Last Rainforest. Now, did you see this one as a kid, Matt?
I did. I actually had it on VHS. It's been a long time since I've seen it, but I used to watch it constantly.
This one, he played Batty Coda, which was a slick, funny, rambunctious, and wisecracking, and of course, multiple-voiced bat, a literal bat, who was a test subject for scientific experiments and everything like that. And he escaped to the rainforest and he had an antenna built into his head, a literal antenna built into his
head.
And he befriended the fairy folk of Ferngully. And this one, we heard Robin Williams sing, we heard him riff, we heard him play different characters. And I'd have to admit that I think I saw Ferngully before I saw Hook, and this is the first film that I really fell in love with Robin Williams.
Yeah, I have to agree. I mean, 1992 was a great year for him voice acting wise because, you know, we got Ferngully and later we'll talk about Aladdin, but I mean, I kind of feel like as long as the directors were cool with letting him riff, I mean, voice acting is perfect for him because he's the man of 1,000, literally 1,000 voices. So he fit into the genre like a glove.
Yeah, and I feel like this was the first time that we really got to see what Robin Williams could do with improvisation and riffing on the big screen. Because obviously he had Mork and Mindy, you know, on TV, and that there was so much improvisation with that show. And, you know, I may be wrong on this one, you know, like if you're bigger fans than I am of Robin Williams, please write us at contact@thenerdparty.com. But I feel like this was the first time that we really got to see him riff on the big screen.
Certainly for our age, because he was doing his stand-up specials as early as the late 70s. And
yes,
if you ever listen to any of his stand-up specials, which I highly recommend, I actually watched a couple in preparation for this show just because I wanted to laugh and have a good time. That is the definition of improvisational comedy because I literally think it's nothing can be planned. I literally think nothing's planned on any of his stand-up. He just goes off the audience and just does whatever feels right. And so people who knew that about him knew that already by the time we got to Ferngully. It's when you and I got introduced to it, because we're roughly the same age, and this was right around the time when we were kids, and this would have been the prime age to expose us to stuff like this.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm a big fan of his comedy, and I love Live at the Met, and I love Live on Broadway. You know, fantastic specials. But yeah, I just meant like on the big screen, like on in film and in cinema. But since you brought up Aladdin, you cannot talk about Robin Williams without talking about Aladdin. And you can't talk about Aladdin without talking about Robin Williams. This movie was made by Robin Williams. If Robin Williams was not in this movie, I don't think it would make that big of a splash.
And he wasn't sure he was going to do it at first.
I didn't know that.
He was kind of iffy on the whole thing. I think he did Aladdin before Ferngully, but I could be wrong. They were both released around the same time, but I think Aladdin was his first go around with voice acting.
Well, Aladdin probably took longer than Ferngully. It's much bigger production.
Right. But like you said, I mean, he created one of the most iconic roles, and you know, along with a couple of other releases at the time, really brought Disney animation back to the forefront in the early 90s. I can remember, I was out of the country when this was released, but I eventually saw it where I was. I was living in Panama at the time, and even overseas it was a huge hit. So, you know, it literally touched the cornerstone of every market.
Yeah, according to some trivia site that I found, is that during the course of going through all of these voices and riffing with Genie and Aladdin, the editors had almost 16 hours of material to cut. 16 hours yes. of voice acting.
And literally, I mean, I've been watching interviews with him as you know, this tragedy happened a couple weeks ago. And he literally just said, guys, can I just try something? And they would be like, okay, sure. And he would just go.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as you gave him permission, he would just go and riff and do whatever he felt was good. And there would be so much material there that was good that they would then have to compress into like an hour and a half to 2 hour film.
Yeah, I was watching Inside the Actor's Studio with James Lipton, and he was interviewing Robin Williams. And if any of you haven't seen it, go watch it now. It's absolutely amazing. It's a two-hour-long interview, well, about an hour and a half or hour 45 minutes once you take out the commercials. And it's one of the longer interviews that James Lipton does, and he does a lot of riffing. I mean, it's all practically improv, and it's just you get to see a lot of insight to his characters and into his – I hate to use this word, but his process. And he was talking about how when he was in the booth doing Genie, that it started out with one animators, then two animators taking notes. And then as they allowed him to riff more and more, it started to be four animators and six animators all packed into one room because he was doing so many different characters and they were just trying to catalog everything. And he ad-libbed so many of his lines that the script was turned down for Best Adapted Screenplay at the Oscars.
Which, you know, it's kind of a fine line to cross, but, I mean, it's hard to deny that kind of talent, and it was just amazing. And literally, I think honestly, on a more serious note, once the news that Robin Williams had passed away broke, Genie was one of the first characters that a lot of people collectively recognized on social media.
That's true. That's absolutely true. Yeah, I noticed that.
And so it watching it now is very, very bittersweet. But he did such an amazing job that, you know, it's iconic.
Decades from now, people will still be talking about Robin Williams playing the genie in Aladdin.
Now, decades from now, they probably won't be talking about this film, but if we could, Tristan, I need to talk about a film that was a personal cornerstone of my childhood. And it's not the one you're thinking of. It's actually Jumanji.
Oh, that was the one I was thinking of.
Oh, so really? There. Okay. Well, fair enough. But this is something that touched my childhood. Now, I had actually
read... Can you show me on the doll where it touched you in your childhood?
Tristan, you're supposed to be PG-13.
I think that's vague enough for younger listeners. But I'm sorry to interrupt. Please continue.
Now, when I heard that there was a movie version of Jumanji coming out, this was in 95, so that would have made me all of 6 years old. But I actually had read the book. It was based on a children's book, Jumanji.
I didn't know that. I really didn't know that.
It was. It's by the same guy who wrote The Polar Express, Chris Van Allsburg.
Oh, okay. Wait. Oh, flashback. Yes, I do remember that. I read those because I was super into Polar Express. And then they, my parents bought me the book, and it came with its own little bell. And I was like, I need to read other stuff by him. That's right. And they gave me Jumanji.
Woo. Yeah, he wrote Jumanji. So I was already real excited because I loved the book. It was such an interesting concept. And then I saw the movie, and I was enthralled. And then about 15 or 20 minutes into the movie is when Robin Williams comes into it. Because if you don't know, the story of Jumanji is it's a mystical game that dangerous things come out of whenever you play, and you have to finish it in order for the dangerous things to go away. Robin Williams' character plays it as a young kid, gets sucked into the game, and is released 26 years later when two more kids start playing the game. But he comes into the picture, and he's bearded and stuff, and I remember not recognizing who he was at first. But then at the point where he shaves it off and he's Robin Williams, I was so excited because I had first seen him in Mrs. Doubtfire and loved him in that. Seen his face. I mean, in Aladdin, you don't see his face. Mm-hmm. But I just remember seeing him come into Jumanji, and I'm like, Mrs. Doubtfire's in this movie. And it was just, I watched that movie on VHS. I wore out the tape. It really, like, that's one of my favorite childhood nostalgic memories of all time. It's the first movie to actually give me nightmares, too, as a kid.
Yeah, you always, I remember after seeing that movie, you always had... You always wanted a game to do that, a board game to do that. You wanted the pieces to move. You wanted the centerpiece to give you different sayings and everything like that. Oh, I wish they could have made that a reality.
You don't understand. I bought the board game because the board game actually came out when the movie was released on VHS. They made a board game version of it, and I bought it, played it all the time. But really, that movie, I think that movie helped me usher in my love of horror because that really freaked me out as a kid. It really did. I still think about parts of that film every now and then, but it is just, it's nothing incredible, but it is such a fun film, and I love the entire cast in that. So
yeah, Bonnie Hunt was by far my favorite in that movie.
I know, and that's when I that's actually when I was introduced to her, and I just thought she was hilarious.
She is hilarious, and I wish we saw more of her. Well, moving on to that came out in 95. And then next up is the movie Jack, which you might have not heard of. It didn't do very well. It got an 18% on Rotten Tomatoes, and it came out the next year in 96. This didn't do so well. This was directed by the legendary Francis Ford Coppola. And it had a dynamite cast with Diane Lane and Bill Cosby and Jennifer Lopez, I guess. And it just...
You're forgetting the nanny. Fran Drescher was in that. I remember
that's
that.
That's right. Fran Drescher was in that. So, okay, I should say half a dynamite cast. It was just roughly, I'll give it to you real quick. It's about a boy. Like, we see Robin Williams' birth, and the birth happened four times as fast as it should have. Like, she didn't reach 9 months. I think it was only, like, 3 or 4 months or something like that. And then he got diagnosed with a disease. He was diagnosed with kind of a weird form of progeria where instead of seeing a little kid have, you know, physically age and like their face get droopy and their hair get gray and their bones get weaker like an old person, we would see Robin Williams, or at least his character, age four times as fast, literally. So when he was 10 years old, he would look like a 40-year-old man, i.e. Robin Williams. And so, you know, it's, how did you describe it to me before?
It's basically like he has Benjamin Button disease, but instead of aging backwards, he's going forwards really quickly.
Yeah. It's kind of a heartbreaking story. It doesn't, I mean, it ends kind of happy, but not really. I don't know. You'll just have to watch it. I don't want to ruin it for you because so many people haven't actually seen it.
I feel like a lot of people are harsh on this movie because the premise is kind of silly and it's kind of dopey and stuff like that. But like I said, I was all of 7 or 8 years old when this came out. I saw it in theaters back then. Robin Williams could do no wrong. So it's firmly implanted in my nostalgia zone. I still appreciate that film.
I want to watch it again because I haven't seen it for years and I really, really liked it. And I actually like the music so much that I bought the soundtrack, the score to this when
it
came
really?
Out. I really did. I really did. Yeah, I bought it in 96 or 97 when the score came out. I think the composer was Michael Kamen, if I remember correctly. All right. Well, after that, because that was in 96. Soon after that, in 97, he was just hitting the genre films year after year in the 90s. He came out with Flubber. Now, I don't want to talk about Flubber too much.
I saw it in the theaters. Again, back then, Robin Williams could do no wrong. And it was entertaining at 8 years old, but I don't remember very much about it today. I just remember Marcia Gay Harden and Will Wheaton were in it.
I forgot Will Wheaton was in it, but I remembered Marcia Gay Harden. She's fantastic. She's phenomenal. I love her. Clancy Brown was in it, too. You know, he has a huge nerd connection everywhere. You know, a scientist makes a weird material, and the weird material turns into Flubber.
It's a purely kids film, and back then I was just the right age for it.
Yeah, it's a 90s Disney live-action kids film. That's all you need to know. All right, now this next one is a genre film that is a little bit on a more serious note. And this one, he took a couple of years off from the genre and came back in 1999 with a highly underrated film, very underrated film. and that's Bicentennial Man.
I feel it was underrated in part because I do seem to remember it being aimed much more as a family comedy sort of thing, like, oh, look at this funny robot butler and it's Robin Williams. In reality, it's very, very sad, that movie.
It's tragic, and it asks questions about life, death, sex, and companionship, taboo relationships, and it asks really hard questions, and it's not a kid's movie. I mean, it has comedic elements about it. You laugh really hard, but you also cry really hard, too. And it was directed by Christopher Columbus. It's based off of the short story by Isaac Asimov by the same name. And this was, I feel like this was a victim not of poor filmmaking, but of poor marketing.
Yeah, exactly.
As you said before.
Exactly. I do remember quite vividly that was marketed as a family comedy.
Now, one film that it's, you know, I don't want to talk about as misses, but it is a genre film. And he took a long time off between Bicentennial Man and this next film, at least when it comes to genre films, when it comes to fantasy or sci-fi. And Bicentennial Man was in 99, and his next one, The Final Cut, was in 2004. Now, I don't remember this actually being released in wide release. I don't remember this being released in theaters, but it was. It was released in only 117 screens, and it made... Just to illustrate you how poorly this movie did, its opening weekend, it made $225,000.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly don't remember this film. And kind of my policy is if a big-name star was in a film and you really haven't heard about it, chances are it's not going to be good. Like, have you ever been to, like, Best Buy or whatever video store you might go to now, Tristan, where you see, like, there's this new DVD of this actor, big-name actor in a movie that you've never heard of and was never released, or you don't think was released in theaters? For me, that's always a red flag. Like, it's probably not going to be good.
Yeah, you're like, oh, this was a straight to DVD. That must make it good. Yeah, no. You know, for those of you who don't know the story, it's about a near future where you can implant this device in your kid's head, I think before birth, that records every moment of their lives through their eyes. And then once they die, what they call a cutter, which is just an editor, a video editor, takes the implant out and then sifts through all of the footage from your entire life and makes like a 2-hour movie of your life.
You mean and the final cut?
The final cut. And yeah, genius. And it was just, I think they called their editing machines the guillotine, which I actually thought was kind of cool. But it was just, Jim Caviezel was in it, and I like Jim Caviezel, I like Robin Williams, but it just didn't have, I don't know, it just didn't have the je ne sais quoi. It just didn't quite make it.
Sounds like Jim Caviezel was trying to get another Frequency. Remember Frequency? That sounds kind of like this.
I loved Frequency. I had the poster of Frequency on my wall.
I remember seeing Frequency in a pay-per-view hotel room when it came out.
I love that movie. I think I saw it in the theaters. All right, well, no, okay. To move along, there's a few other movies that we could talk about that are genre films. Like, there's Robots, where he was a voice. There was Happy Feet, where he's a voice. And those are technically genre films. But I don't really want to talk about those films. I want to go straight to Night at the Museum. Now, Night at the Museum has spawned two sequels. And it's actually going to be one of, if not Robin Williams' last film
that he made. I wouldn't be surprised if in this new film we're going to see a in memory of, or this film is dedicated to Robin Williams.
Right. And Night at the Museum didn't really connect with me the first time I watched it, but whenever I catch it on cable or, you know, whenever it's on, I catch myself watching it and I like it more and more. And I definitely liked his performance in it. I thought he brought something unique and different. And I mean, him playing Teddy Roosevelt just totally makes sense.
It did, and he was very good. And I've only seen the first one, to be honest with you. I mean, there was nothing. I enjoyed the first one. I thought it was kind of clever, kind of funny. Nothing really made me want to go back to see the sequels, but I'm sure he does just as well in them. But yeah, that first one was kind of fun, and him playing Robin Williams, him playing Theodore Roosevelt was a lot of fun. And if I remember correctly, wasn't Dick Van Dyke the bad guy in that first one?
Yes, he was. Dick Van Dyke playing a bad guy, that'll just never sit well with me. Yeah,
him him not doing a Cockney British accent won't ever sit well with me.
Whenever the Brits I know, whenever they want to make fun of Americans for trying to do a British accent, that's their go-to person.
Yeah.
Whenever I've hung out with Europeans or Londoners or anything like that, I tell them, I was like, oh, you know, I did some acting in high school and college and everything like that. And I was like, oh, yeah, I played so-and-so in that play. They're like, isn't that person British? I was like, yeah, I put on an accent. They're like, how about you give it to us right now? And I'd give them some crappy English accent. They're like, really? And they're like, doesn't that sound a bit like, hello, Mary Poppins? That is what they think Yanks sound like whenever Americans do a British accent. They think they sound like Dick Van Dyke and Mary Poppins.
Yeah, well, maybe they do. We'll never know.
We'll never know because we're not Brits.
We're only dumb Americans.
We're only dumb Americans and bloody Yanks. All right, now, what movie I want to talk about to wrap up the genre portion is a movie that we're taking out of temporal order. And Nighting Museum came out in 2006, and the sequels obviously came out afterwards. And the movie we're going to talk about came out in 1998, and that's What Dreams May Come.
From what I remember, a very, very poignant, beautiful film that I am still kicking myself didn't get to rewatch within the last couple of weeks just because life got in the way. But from what I can recall, this is one of my dad's favorite films, and he loves this sort of thing. So
this was originally a novel, and I watched this film after Robin Williams' death. I mean, I watched it a lot before. This is one of my favorite films. This is literally one of my favorite films. And I'm not just saying that because he passed away and the movie's about death. This was a movie that was another underrated Robin Williams film. This was a lot of people, it's fashionable to make fun of this movie. And I don't quite know why people didn't connect with it, because like you said, it's beautiful, it's gorgeous, it's poignant. It asks questions about death. It asks questions about suicide. And that was one of the reasons why this was so difficult to watch. And this was, I owned this on DVD, and I had no idea why I didn't buy the Blu-ray as soon as it came out. But right when Robin Williams passed away, I went to Amazon and ordered it, and it came, and I was able to watch it before this podcast. And it is so, it's watching it on Blu-ray was like watching it for the first time. And it was rough to watch, and because Robin Williams' character dies in it and goes to heaven. And not only that, but it deals with suicide. Now, his character didn't commit suicide, but his wife did. And obviously, you know, if you've been not living in the woods or underneath a rock, that Robin Williams committed suicide. And it just adds that much more gravity to the movie and that much more depth to the role, because you can actually put Robin Williams in it and not just his character.
Yeah, I'll be talking about that when we get to other films on our list as well, but What Dreams May Come is going to be one of those films that, like all of his films, but especially that film, that we're never going to be able to watch it in quite the same way again.
Yeah, and, you know, there's only so much that you can say about it. I mean, Cuba Gooding Jr. does an amazing job, and I'm not that big of a fan of Cuba Gooding Jr., but he really nails it. This is his wheelhouse. I wish he could have stuck with roles like this. And, you know, like, we get to see a little bit of funny Robin Williams, and we get to see some serious Robin Williams without the beard. Imagine that. Well, and
also, I mean, this was prime time for both of them, because both of them at this point in 1998 are in their post-Oscar heyday. Mm-hmm. Robin Williams just got one, and Cuba Gooding Jr. had gotten one 2 years prior.
That's right. I mean, this was supposed to be their upswing, but it just didn't connect with audiences.
Which I think is true back then, but I think especially since his passing away, this has had a resurgence.
I think so too, and I think that happens a lot with art. I mean, that happens a lot with, you know, singers and songwriters and painters and dancers. It's just, you know, the art that they created wasn't respected while they were alive. Now, granted, Robin Williams was very much respected. I'm not trying to say that, but I think some performances will be looked at very differently in the future.
Yeah. I mean, it's always the way. It's that old cliche saying about how you're never truly appreciated or missed until you're dead as an artist. And
yeah.
Like I said, it's cliche, but it's absolutely true. I mean, you go look at iTunes, for example, the week following the passing of Robin Williams, and all of his films shot up.
I'm so glad that you brought that up, because like the day after he passed away, I turn on my Apple TV, and normally up on the top of the screen is all the recent releases that you can watch, like Captain America and Spider-Man 2, you know, and things like that, things that just got released. But the thing is, all of these Robin Williams movies were up there instead. Now, some of the new releases, but most of them were Robin Williams films from the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, quite honestly, the first impulse I had when I heard about Robin Williams' passing is I want to see his films again immediately.
And I did too. And so I immediately went on Amazon and said, I was like, okay, these are the movies that I'm going to buy. And every single one, Matt, said temporarily out of stock.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we kind of just rediscover how much we loved and, you know, wish we could have appreciated even more while they were living, these artists that bring these kind of joy and entertainment and wonder into our lives. And I think that ends the genre list that we had prepared. So why don't we talk about some of the films we personally rewatched during our preparation for this show, Tristan?
Yes, let's go into the non-genre films, and let's screw temporal order, and let's just go with the one that everyone is thinking about. And what is that, Matt?
Well, for me, the first thing that I thought about post his passing was Mrs. Doubtfire, because that's the first Robin Williams that I ever saw. And I remember I was here in Tucson. I was visiting with my family was here visiting with my other family. Me, my mother, and my grandmother took me to the theater. I have vivid memories of this. It's probably one of the first vivid memories I have going to a movie to see this film in theaters.
This one is a movie I think most people forget how funny it actually is. I mean, everybody knows, oh yeah, no, it's a comedy. It's a funny movie. It's a funny Robin Williams film. No, this movie's freaking funny. And I am definitely one of those people who forgot how funny this was until I watched Inside the Actor's Studio the day that he passed, and they showed a clip from it, and it's during that that montage of him calling up his ex-wife and pretending to be different horrible maids and babysitters to steer her towards the person he wanted her to go towards. And one
Work with the males because I used to be one.
Yeah, I don't work with the males because I used to be one. Yeah, there was, and the one that really got me though is like, it's like, hello, I am Job. I'm sorry, do you speak English? I am Job. I obviously I'm not giving it justice, but I freaking lost it. I was like, I have to watch this movie. I immediately went to the library and picked it up.
And you have no idea how funny that was to a four-year-old, Tristan, watching that sort of stuff in theaters. I mean, I didn't quite understand it at the time.
Yeah, but he was not just
doing,
all of it.
But he was just doing funny voices, you know, as a kid. And that's always good for a laugh. And, you know, Mrs. Doubtfire is kind of funny because I loved it as a kid. And then I rewatched it as I'm getting older, and I'm understanding more and more of the subtle humor that they put in there for the adults.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just hilarious. I mean, me and my friends were watching this about, I think it was around last Christmas, actually. We were just decided, we were all hanging out at his apartment, and we were just going to watch Mrs. Doubtfire. And there was a specific joke in there that we never remembered existed, and all of us fell on the floor laughing. And it's when there's a scene where he's talking with Sally Field in the kitchen as Mrs. Doubtfire, and he's talking about how his quote-unquote husband passed away. And he was like, 'twas the drink that killed him. Oh, was he an alcoholic? No, he was hit by a Guinness truck. And we just lost it. We lost it. I had no recollection of that joke being in there. And it's kind of a, you know, it's a chuckle joke, but we just fell on the floor. It was so funny.
Yeah, no, it's filled with little moments like that where you don't quite understand it at first, or you may not have noticed it first, and then once you get it, you just roll on the floor laughing. Absolutely.
And you know, talk about the one-liners. I could quote this movie all day. I mean, my first day as a woman and I'm getting hot flashes.
Yeah, it's filled with stuff like that, and that's the beauty of Robin Williams movies, that you are guaranteed at least 50 fantastic one-liners. Now, that is definitely the movie that you think of when you think comedic Robin Williams. That one, that definitely had the star power behind it, and it really resonated within our zeitgeist. But towards the dramatic side, I think we can all agree that that's the movie that won him the Oscar, and that's Good Will Hunting.
Yes, it's again been a while since I've seen this, but I do remember how impactful that performance was, and it, obviously it was the first time we had heard of either Matt Damon or Ben Affleck coming into the forefront. And I think Robin Williams really helped make this movie as impactful as it was, and really helped put them on the map as both writers and movie stars. So, you know, we just a great ensemble cast, because it's the three of them. I remember Minnie Driver's in it.
Yeah.
But, you know, everyone remembers the It's Not Your Fault scene.
Yeah, that was a pretty powerful scene, and that's been mimicked a lot by other movies who just can't do it justice and just can't copy it, but they try. And that movie was so powerful, and the script was so powerful, and Robin Williams is the reason why the movie got made. Robin Williams is the reason why Matt Damon and Ben Affleck have careers.
Yeah, to which I know, you know, you see on Twitter that they're very grateful, and just a hell of a film. And talk about things that have been imitated, especially over the past couple of weeks, Tristan, as far as his dramatic roles are concerned. We have to talk about O Captain, My Captain in Dead Poets Society.
This was actually the first movie that I watched when he passed, and that's and the main reason why is because my wife, who is a drama teacher and an English teacher, had never seen this film. And
really?
I said, I was like, my goodness, woman, you have to watch this with me. And it was very poignant. She was crying at the end, just like you would expect her to. And it was really nice watching it with someone who had never seen it before. And I had forgotten a lot about this movie and forgotten how powerful it actually was.
Me too. And I literally saw this, Tristan, today. Maybe not less than 5 hours ago, rewatching it again for the first time in a long time. And wow, what a film that is. And what I would have given to have, and what I would have given anything to have a teacher like Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society. I mean, yes, he was funny in it, but I felt like every line that they gave him and the way he delivered it just was so impactful. You know, aside from the carpe diem, and you know, that was a very famous scene from that, but you know, the one that sticks out to me is when he has the boys in the class huddled around him near the beginning of the class, and he ends his little speech or whatever he's given with to talk about the importance of making a legacy in life, and he says, "What will your verse be?" And that, I just thought, what a brilliant line. That's perfect.
And once again, this is a powerful, dramatic Robin Williams film that deals with suicide.
And I just thought of that as I was watching it, and I'm like, wow, this is really, really, this takes on a whole new meaning now.
It's hard to watch with that added depth. And that scene when Robin Williams is crying at the student's desk who did commit suicide, it's wrenching. It's heart-wrenching. It's absolutely...
I'm not afraid to say I had to shut my door in my office at work as I was watching this, because that scene really got to me.
Yeah, it's some man tears, huh?
I did, both at that and, not swear, hand of my heart, at the end of Mrs. Doubtfire as well.
You told me about that. You told me about how you cried at the end of Mrs. Doubtfire.
Well, it was just so sad. And, you know, when he finally says bye-bye at the end, it's kind of like, that's it, you know?
Bye-bye. Oh, also, by the way, all the movies that we're mentioning today, folks, are movies that Matt and I have watched since August 11th.
Yes.
Now, it's not the first time we've seen them, but it's during our rewatch, preparing for this podcast.
These are the ones that we watched in preparation for this show. And another one that kind of took place, I think it was a couple years before Dead Poets Society, that I also rewatched today, was Good Morning Vietnam. And this was kind of he had done Popeye, and he had done World According to Garp, which I know a lot of people give him a lot of credit for, and I do want to go back and rewatch that. But I feel like Good Morning Vietnam was his first big film that put him on the map as far as a mainstream Hollywood was concerned, post Mork and Mindy.
I'm man enough to admit it, but I had never seen this film until a couple of days ago.
Really?
Yeah, it was one that just I kept missing. I just didn't take the time to watch it. I never caught it on cable, never caught it on TV, and I never rented it. And it wasn't until he passed away that I was like, I need to see this movie. And I enjoyed it. I mean, it didn't smack me across the face. I didn't fall in love with it with like a lot of other people, but I enjoyed lots of it.
Now, I think the surprising thing for me is that I really like this film. It's been a while since I've seen this one as well, but I remember really enjoying it, and seeing it as an adult now, I enjoyed it even more. I kind of feel like it was a very nice blend of both comedy and drama, and you get the poignancy, and especially now that I hear about all the work that Robin Williams did in real life for the troops. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's the great scene in Good Morning Vietnam where he's been suspended off the air and is really disillusioned with the whole everything that's going on in Vietnam, as anyone would be. But there's a point where Forrest Whitaker is trying to get him back into hosting the show again. And to do that, he actually takes him, the character, to go entertain the troops before they go out on the front lines. And you could see that, you know, he's playing this role in this film, but this is what the man did for the troops in real life. And that can't help but come through on the screen. And I really like that scene. It stuck out to me this time.
I think, yeah, that was definitely my favorite scene. And I think you explained it well. I think you hit it on the head. Now, just a few more. One that we both watched on our rewatch is one that kind of flew under the radar, but is a very, very creepy film. And that's One Hour Photo.
I had never seen this before the rewatch for this because I had heard so much hype behind this. I was like, and I'm a horror fan. Like, this is in my wheelhouse. So I was like, I gotta check this out. And wow, I was truly, truly impressed. I had not seen Robin Williams play a quote unquote villain before, or a twisted character. And it fits so well. He just has that quality where he can tweak it, where it, you know, he does a comedy role and just slightly tweak it, and all of a sudden it's creepy. And it's, I would almost call this the way he is in this film, very, very Anthony Perkins, Norman Bates-ish. I mean, he's so mild-mannered and quiet and unassuming.
And also sad.
And sad.
Also a sad character, a very sad character. And there's certain times when you actually sympathize with him. For those of you who don't know what this film is, a short description is, an employee of a one-hour photo lab becomes obsessed with a young suburban family. For years, they have a 10-year-old kid. And for something like 10 years, he's made double copies of all the films that they bring in and drop off. Because back in the day, kids, you had to take your film to a photo lab and they would develop it for you and then hand you the prints. And so he would make copies for himself and plaster them all over his wall.
Yeah, this is the thing, right? At the beginning of the film, he just kind of seems a little off kilter and maybe a little friendly with this family, but nothing really out of the ordinary until this man goes into his apartment and you literally see it's just a huge wall of all this family's photographs over the last 10 years plastered that takes up this entire wall, and you realize just how crazy this guy is.
Yeah, you realize that he's positively crazy, and this is really a movie of the time, and this is not really something that would connect with the audience today, 12 years later, because we're in the digital age, and because like the 2002 was the beginning of the digital age, and it was just it's probably like the idea of it is still very scary, but I think if this movie was released, obviously no one would know what the hell you're talking about.
Well, sure, but maybe it's because I lived during that time, or maybe because I really have a nice suspension of disbelief where I can step out of myself and realize, okay, this is when this film was made, mm-hmm. This is what was going on at the time, that it completely didn't bother me as someone who was watching this for the first time in 2014.
Oh, yeah, I think definitely because we are the age that we are, because we live through this kind of time, I think we can definitely connect with it. I actually saw this in theaters.
Really?
Yeah, no joke, I saw this in theaters. And the sad part is I think I was the only one.
Because I don't remember this coming out. And you would think that I would, but I think it's Fox Searchlight, so it was probably like a smaller release, kind of under the radar thing, but very, very solid psychological thriller, and he gives a great performance in it.
Yeah, opening weekend, it only in the U.S. it only released in 7 screens. That's it on opening weekend.
Yeah, very limited release.
Yeah, it had a much wider release overseas on opening weekend. But this one, I keep saying opening weekend, but it only made $321,000.
But for 7 we have to take that in proportion. For 7 screens, that might be not bad.
Yeah, but also, you know, the budget was $12 million. which I was really surprised when I read that number, because when you look at it, it does not look like, obviously today $12 million isn't that much, and we're only talking about 12 years ago, but $12 million is kind of a lot for what you see on screen.
It really is.
Like, how this movie was shot, it looks very, not cheap as in, like, oh, fakey or unreal, it looks cheap as in, like, oh, this is a good idea, and so you don't need special effects, you don't need fancy camera work. It's just very straightforward filmmaking.
I think the word you're looking for, Tristan, is minimalist. It's a very there minimalist film.
That's a much better term. Now, to wrap up our story and wrap up our review, we have to end on one of the greatest comedies of all time, and I say that without sarcasm and not trying to be sardonic in whatsoever, and we won't spend too much time talking about it because we talked about it a lot on our last show, and that is The Birdcage.
Now, you can imagine, Tristan, how much I've seen this film over the years. I think it's sort of a rite of passage as a gay guy that you have to watch The Birdcage at some point. And don't even get me started on quotable lines from this one. I'll just say that much.
This is the one. I quote this movie in my daily life, and this came out in 96. And it's just, it could have been made today, and it still would have been as funny. It could have been made 20 years before, and it still would have been as funny. And it's just, Robin Williams, Gene Hackman, Nathan Lane, Diane Wiest, Calista Flockhart, Hank Azaria. My goodness, Christine Baranski.
But you know what? You know what the funny thing is about this film, Tristan? I think Nathan Lane and Robin Williams make a great comedy duo. But for the first time, I think, in Robin Williams' comedy career, he's not the over-the-top person of the comedy duo. He gives that to Nathan Lane. Robin Williams is actually kind of the more grounded one in this film.
And they originally wanted him to play Nathan Lane's character.
Really? I did not know that.
Yeah, they wanted, because of his personality, because of his real personality and all the roles that he played before, they wanted him to be the over-the-top guy. Like, oh yeah, over-the-top Robin Williams. He's, you know, big personality. But the thing is, I think he convinced them. He's like, no, you need, like once they brought on Nathan Lane, they're like, no, Nathan needs to be this role. I need to be this role. And it was a fantastic decision.
It was the best possible decision that they could go with, because my goodness, that film is just outstandingly funny. And, you know, by the time we get to the dinner scene at the end, I am just in tears. It's so funny.
And for those of you who don't know what the film is, shame on you. Go and watch it right now. It's a gay cabaret owner and his drag queen companion agree to put up a false straight front so that their son can introduce them to his fiancé's right-wing moralistic parents.
His son, who's, you know, in rewatching this movie, the son's a real dick in this.
He really is. And the thing is, like, they put up this huge facade where, okay, they're not a gay couple. Like, Robin Williams isn't gay, and they try to hide his partner Nathan Lane and get his real mother in the case. There, they change his last name so that they don't find out that he's Jewish. And I'm like, how long could that facade go on? Because eventually, if you do actually get married, I think you have to give the real last name at the wedding. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm just
maybe.
Guessing here.
Or, you know, you're never going to come over for the holidays, because I'll tell you what, as if I was in that position, I wouldn't even do that once, much less having to do it every time they come over.
Yeah, this is definitely a movie that you have to kind of suspend your disbelief when it comes to the antics, the wild antics that come in. But the thing is, this was originally based on a French stage play.
Yes, it was. La Cage aux Folles.
And it was... I wish I could see a stage version of this, because you know that there's so many... That dinner scene is so long and so great, but you don't get bored because it's so entertaining.
Yeah. I would like to see it with Nathan Lane. He does Broadway. He could still do this, and I would love it.
One of my goals in life is to see Nathan Lane on stage. No joke.
No, he's fantastic. But... God, just one of my favorite films. That was one of the first things I rewatched in preparation for this, and laughed the full way through.
All right. Well, that was our show on the retrospective of Robin Williams genre films and non-genre films that we rewatched since his passing. And we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to find out what you guys think about Robin Williams or what you think about his movies. What are some of your favorite genre films of his, or what are your favorite non-genre films? Go to contact@thenerdparty.com and let us know. Send us an email. And please, please, please go to iTunes, go to Stitcher, and hit subscribe. And speaking of Stitcher, Philip Clark, also known as ABC's dad on Twitter, wrote into us, contacted us on Twitter, and told us that he wrote us our first review on Stitcher, and we want to thank him for being a loyal listener. And please don't let him be the only one. Please go to Stitcher, go to iTunes, hit subscribe, write us a review. And if you write us a 5-star review, we'll mention you on the podcast. And it just, the more you rate us, the more you review us, and the more you subscribe, the more shows we'll be able to do, the higher we'll raise on people's lists, the more listeners we'll get. And that's just better for everyone, I think.
It is. And, you know, we're still in our, you know, novice stage as far as this this particular show is concerned. Tristan and I are having a great time, though, and we want to know if you guys are having as good a time as we are. We hope so. So definitely write into us and let us know what you think of the show.
And please let us know when you write a review, because we don't check it every day. We try to check it as often as possible. And especially if you're a non-US listener, we don't always have access to overseas iTunes stores or overseas Stitcher stores. So please give us an email at contact@thenerdparty.com. Matt, how can we find you online?
You can find me personally online on Twitter at mhansen0207, H-A-N-S-E-N.
And you can find me at TheInsaneRobin on Twitter. Until next week, thank you for joining the Nerd Party.
Coming up next week.
Yeah. All right, quick. I got 3 questions. How much do I love you? Question number 2. How much do you love me? Last question. Question number 3. Why aren't we watching any footage yet?
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
For years and years, heating has meant boilers, and boilers have meant breakdowns. Over here, and over here. Anything but music to your ears. At Fisher Future Heat, we create state-of-the-art home heating systems that we fit, then you forget. With no annual servicing needed, and a huge 10-year guarantee. In short, we engineer common sense. Search Fisher Future Heat today. Fisher Future Heat. The future is electric.